to his neck as he rummaged about where the stone had dropped.
"It's times like this that I wish Onslow were a turtle instead of a tortoise," Clive said.
He let out a yelp of pain, lurching to his feet and waving his arm around. A small figure was being flailed about, its teeth clamped onto Clive's hand. It was thrown off and started hovering in the air. It was a small, fairy-like figure, about the size of a human hand, with a naked androgynous body, dark blue hair, and insect wings that buzzed rapidly to keep it aloft. Clutched in its arms was the Awakening Stone, almost as big as it was. The stone was wet, muddy, and under the weight of it, the creature could barely hold itself in the air. It tried to fly off with its prize, but the stone was too much, slipping through its arms and back into the water. A furious Clive made a grab at the creature, but it flitted away, turning back to poke its tongue out before zipping away through the air.
"I hate those things,"
Clive muttered, as he smeared healing ointment over the wound on his hand.
"You've seen those before?" Jason asked.
"Wetland pixies."
"Oh, yeah.
They love eating eagles, so they were always hanging about the farm when I was growing up. I can't tell you how many boots Nana lost throwing them at the damn things. She never hit anything, and the boots usually landed in the bog."
"Well, you'd best get back down and grab the stone," Jason said. "There might be more of those things in there."
Chapter 27 Potential. In his guest suite in the Cloud Palace, Rufus was at a desk with papers arrayed in front of him. Ground assessments, potential designs, integration requirements. He wearily ran his hands over his face, trying to maintain concentration. While he awaited word on various investigations, Rufus had resumed the task of establishing the Academy annex he was working on with the Geller family. Adras Dorgan had kept his word and was making progress in chasing down the materials on the lists provided by Clive and now Russell. Certain shipments had come into the port at Hornus before being moved to private vessels for destinations thus far unknown. Dorgan was currently digging deeper into the ownership of those private vessels. Rufus found his attention constantly straying to builder cultists, the nebulous enemy who, at that very moment, was hidden away advancing their destructive plots. He wondered how many more friends he would lose before they were finally stopped. After getting up, he walked out onto the balcony and let the sea breeze wash refreshingly over him. He decided to leave the work for the moment and go find Gary, who seemed equally at a loss after finishing his own project with the constructs. They hadn't seen much of one another since coming back from the expedition, and there was a friction there that Farah had always smoothed out. Jason's presence had helped them through the worst of it in the wake of her death, but her absence lingered between them. Rufus and Gary had adjacent suites in the guest wing, connected by a terrace. Rufus wandered over and saw Gary inside with a half-empty bottle of some rot gut he must have bought in the city. Emir would never stock anything so cheap and nasty. Gary had dissolved the entire outer wall of his suite, leaving it open to the fresh air. Gary, slouched in a chair, nodded his acknowledgement of Rufus's arrival.
"Day drinking?" Rufus asked. "It's barely mid-morning."
"Want to join?" Gary asked.
"Yes," Rufus said, walking over to a cabinet and grabbing a glass.
"We can do it out here?" Sophie asked, looking uncertainly at the village around them.
"Clive can," Jason said. "He's more flexible than most, so he can do it just about anywhere you have a flat space."
"It might seem unusual for the two of you to just up and do it in the middle of a village square," Humphrey said, "but it's something the villagers will be eager to see."
"It won't take long," Jason said. "Clive can just slip it into you out here and we can head off."
"He's right. It won't take long," Clive assured her. "Even in less comfortable conditions, I'm very quick to finish."
"All right," Sophie said. "It's not like it's my first time."
"You heard the lady, Clive," Jason said. "Whip it out."
Clive took out the Awakening Stone they retrieved from the marsh and passed it to Sophie.
"Item, Awakening Stone of the Rain. Unranked, common. An Awakening Stone containing the power of rain. Consumable, Awakening Stone. requirements, unawakened essence ability. Effect, awakens an essence ability. You have 8 unawakened essence abilities.
Using his abilities, Clive balanced out the ambient magic and drew a ritual circle. As Humphrey predicted, doing so in the village square drew curious onlookers. The ritual went off without incident, awakening Sophie's new ability.
Ability, between the raindrops, swift. Special ability, cost, high mana per second and high stamina per second. Cooldown, none. Current rank, iron, 0.00%. Effect, iron. Increased reflexes and spatial awareness.
That's it? Humphrey asked. That seems like an exhaustive cost for increased reflexes.
Attack her, Jason said.
What? Humphrey asked.
Attack her, Jason said. You come in from the right and I'll pincer her from the left.
I'm not sure that's a good idea.
Do it, Sophie said. No weapons. I won't hurt you too badly.
Jason grinned and leapt forward, Humphrey doing the same with a grimace. They unleashed simultaneously from either side, but it was like Sophie had eyes in the back of her head. Not only did she react to their every move, but she did so the moment they made them. Soon Humphrey was sent stumbling back from a kick to the face. Jason had it worse, folded over on the ground as he clutched his crotch with both hands.
Did you have to go right for the plums? He squeaked out.
She walked over and looked down at him.
You're the one who wanted to attack me, she said.
Neil Devone had started spending time at the Mercer family compound as a boy. Thadwick had needed friends his own age, and the Devone and Kettering families, with their close ties to the Mercers, had frequently sent their own boys over. The Mercer residence was the most impressive in Greenstone, with its 5 interconnected towers and immaculate grounds. Even with tyrannical toddler Thadwick as a playmate, it had always been an exciting place to visit, growing up. As he had gotten older, the attractions of the Mercer household for Neil went through various changes. As he became more curious about the world, the impressive library fed his mind. When he became an essence user, he made full use of the training facilities that Thadwick disdained. The rest of the Mercers were more than happy to let Neil and his teammate Dustin use them as much as they liked. After all, their job was to keep Thadwick alive. Another change in what made the Mercer compound alluring as Neil grew up was the presence of Thadwick's older sister, Cassandra. As with many young men in the Mercer family orbit, the smart, capable, and gorgeous young woman was the object of his youthful affection. 4 years older than him, she was the unattainable image of beauty and sophistication in the eyes of 13-year-old Neil. She left the city with her mother after reaching bronze rank, putting an end to his boyhood crush. Cassandra and her mother had been back in the city for 6 months, in preparation for the monster surge. Many young men once again clamoured for her attention, but Neil was not one of them. It had been one thing putting up with Thadwick as children, but they were adventurers now. His selfishness and incompetence brought with it genuine danger, culminating in his abandonment of them during the expedition. Aside from Cassandra and her mother, the ones who had left, he had become soured on anything with the Mercer name. Any idea of reigniting youthful passions and pursuing her ended the moment he thought of her family. By the time he had heard that Cassandra and Jason Asano were an item, he had seen Asano for himself and not found him to be anything special. He was just another in a line of self-impressed people who thought they were bold and clever for making Thadwick look like a fool. Neil knew it may have just been his lingering affection, but his opinion of Cassandra was still high enough that he wondered what she saw that elevated Asano above the pack. Asano's visit to Neil's home had left him uncertain as to what to do. Ostensibly, Neil had received better offers. The only real attraction to joining Asano's team was the participation of Humphrey Geller. Neil knew for a fact that, behind closed doors, Humphrey was the person the Mercers wished Thadwick had become. Their family situations had provided Thadwick and Humphrey with the same opportunities, yet Humphrey was lauded while Thadwick was dismissed. After Asano's visit to his home, Neil's intention had been to dismiss the offer out of hand. There were things about Asano that kept playing on his mind, however, starting with why he had been the one to make the approach.
Every way he looked at it, Humphrey Geller would have made the better advocate. Asano's characteristically idiosyncratic conduct bore that out. The absurdity of questioning Neil's elven heritage. Asano's description of his own team that was anything but appealing. Then there was Asano spending most of his time explaining not why Neil would want to join them, but why they wanted him to join. Although Neil didn't understand it, there was no question that Asano was good at impressing important people, people themselves deserving of respect. The Gellers, the gold-ranked Emir Bahadir, the Vitesse adventurers. Even his enemies were impressive. He was already moving in vaunted circles, to the point that even when he drew hatred, it was from people so far above him they shouldn't care. There were rumours of Asano feuding with the directors of both the Magic and Adventure Societies. If true, that was madness for an Iron Ranker. Then there was whatever had made Cassandra look at him above all the numerous men in Greenstone vying for her attention. The character of Asano aside, critical when choosing a team, was the team's strength as adventurers. Neil knew almost nothing about the two others, but what Asano had told him didn't sound promising. Humphrey, on the other hand, was known to be one of the most proficient Iron Rankers in the city. As for Asano, at least as an adventurer, he seemed capable. Thadwick's fixation had given Neil a fairly good idea of Asano's record. He had closed out a startling number of contracts in a handful of months, each punctuated with adventure board notices. In all of them, he didn't have a single listed failure. Asano had risen through the ranks fast, and fallen even faster, but there were plenty of demotions going around. He had seen multiple recordings of Asano fighting. Everyone had seen the one from the Geller's Mirage Chamber with Asano's overwrought theatrics. Neil had seen others where Asano had been fighting for real. His melodrama was replaced with brutal efficiency. Thadwick had been furious after hearing about Asano spending time with Cassandra and, in typical reactionary fashion, sent a handful of goons to beat Asano down. After what Asano did to the first one, the others not only gave up, but gave Asano directions to where he was going. Neil had only heard about it after the fact, or he would have had Thadwick's father put a stop to it. Thadwick stupidly had his goons record the whole debacle. His father had tasked Neil with retrieving them all. The strongest of Thadwick's bottom feeders was Jerick, who Thadwick had playing muscle in his ill-considered land grab scheme. Neil had been in the room when Thadwick's father tore strips off him for the planned spectacular failure. Asano had recorded his gathering evidence, and the recording ended with Asano fighting Jerick. Thadwick's father had taken the time to point out that Asano wasn't even fighting at his best. Against an armored enemy, Asano should have kept hidden and used his leech familiar to crawl into the armor. Instead, he fought out in the open, suffering more damage than necessary. Asano was using a life-and-death battle with Thadwick's strongest thug as training. The final recording Neil had seen of Asano was when 12 men had confronted him in the street. 4 were thugs Asano had run off in a previous recording, plus double that number of extras. A dozen admittedly mediocre adventurers, yet Asano made the 12-on-1 fight seem lopsided in his favour. 5 adventurers killed in a shopping arcade in broad daylight, and the only repercussion was that it possibly contributed to his later demotion. It was well known that Asano had faced a bronze rank Marsh Hydra with Humphrey Geller and some other guy no one had heard of. Everyone said that Humphrey had carried them through, including Asano himself, but Neil had come away from his conversation with Asano less certain of that. He knew Beth Cavendish thought highly of Jason's abilities, and her judgment was razor sharp. As those thoughts chased themselves around his head, Neil arrived at the Mercer family home for the first time since the expedition. In the aftermath of that disaster, Thadwick had been isolated by the family. Then he disbanded their team without notice. He had considered confronting Thadwick until he talked with their other team member, Dustin. In the end, they were just happy to be free with what was left of their reputations after being known as Thadwick's flunkies. Neil approached one of the 5 gates that were the primary entrances to the Mercer family grounds.
Neil Devone,
the Iron Rank guard said from the other side of the gate as he spotted Neil's approach. The Mercer family guards had long known Neil, but the usual respect was nowhere on this guard's face.
It was clear that, in his eyes, Neil had lost his status as a valued ally of the Mercers. Now he was just another Iron Ranker, like the guard himself.
"I'd like to see Cassandra Mercer," Neil told him.
"I bet you would,"
the guard said insolently.
"Excuse me?
I'm not going to interrupt her for the likes of you."
"Are you being serious right now?"
"Move on, Devone. You don't get a seat at the big table anymore."
"Yes, he does," Thalia Mercer said, teleporting next to the guard. "Hello, Neil."
"Lady Mercer," Neil greeted respectfully.
"First, let me correct this man who used to work for us and tell you that you are always welcome here. Your family is important to us, and you have always given my son loyalty he sadly never earned. What brings you by?"
"I wanted to ask your daughter about Jason Asano."
"Why?"
"He invited me to join his team. I'll probably decline, but I found him odd to talk to. I wanted to know more." Thalia touched the gate, which slid soundlessly to the side.
"I see. If you don't mind, Jason is a topic I would rather you not engage my daughter in. She's unhappy with the family right now, and I don't want to exacerbate that feeling."
"Of course," Neil said. "My apologies for taking your time, Lady Mercer. I'll go."
"Please don't," she said. "Perhaps you can spare me a moment instead."
"Of course, Lady Mercer." She turned on the guard, who had been hovering silently throughout the conversation.
"You, get to the security station and have them send a replacement. If I can assuage your offence to Master Devone, there may be a chance of you maintaining your employment."
The guard nodded and scurried away.
"That's not necessary, Lady Mercer," Neil said.
"Nonsense," she said. "Please come through."
After a moment's hesitation, Neil walked through the gate, which she closed behind him.
"Would you care to take morning tea with me?"
"I wouldn't presume, Lady Mercer."
"Nonsense. Please do."
"Then thank you, Lady Mercer."
It did not go unnoticed by Neil that being led to a private social meeting with Thalia Mercer in the eyes of the whole household made a pointed statement about his status. She led him to the Blue Parlour, one of the various receiving parlours of the Mercer household. Each was named for the primary colour of its decoration, with the Blue Parlour awash in oceanic shades. It was one of the smaller parlours for intimate and respected guests. Shortly after their arrival, a maid delivered tea and small savouries before departing. Thalia poured a cup for each of them.
"I know that your family's tea standards are very high," she said. "I hope you don't look down on us too much."
"Never," Neil said.
"Such a good young man you've become. So, you are considering joining Jason Asano and Humphrey Geller's team?"
"Not really," Neil said. "It's just that some things about the way he made the approach have left me confused."
"Perhaps I can help you with answers. When my daughter became interested in Asano, I looked into him as deeply as I think anyone has."
"Oh?"
"He was rather rude the last time we met, which I am quite happy with."
"Happy?"
"If he was unaffected by being severed from my daughter, I would have been quite dissatisfied. He is startlingly good for his rank at keeping his emotions out of his aura, but when I met him, he was rather a mess. The anger of youthful passion meant his feelings were genuine. That's always a concern when it comes to aristocratic relationships. Is there some young thing you are pursuing, Neil?"
"No, Lady Mercer. My attention is on my future as an adventurer."
"Yes, you're pondering Jason's offer. I know he seems erratic, but you'll find there is method to his madness. He has a way of leaving people thinking exactly what he wants them to."
"How so?" Neil asked.
"You said yourself you will probably turn him down, yet here you are asking questions. Why?"
"There were oddities in the way he tried to recruit me. It's like he was hiding reasons to join and giving me ones not to." Thalia smiled.
"There you are. Humphrey Geller aside, his team is not enticing at a glance, and he knew an ordinary invitation wouldn't work. Otherwise, he would have sent Humphrey. Instead, he found a way to pique your interest. He saw a path that led to you joining his team, and he put you on it." You're saying he manipulated me, and I should refuse the offer.
I'm saying he manipulated you and you should accept the offer. Some within these walls will tell you Jason is unreliable. He's not. When it's time to work, he gets the job done. My original intention was to place him and Humphrey with Cassandra, once they reached bronze rank. That is no longer an option. But if I were in your position, I'd join his team in a heartbeat.
That's not what I would have expected from you, Neil said.
Most adventurers in this city never leave it, and nor should they. They're mediocre, without the potential to thrive in a dangerous world. What they lack in themselves, they fail to recognize in others. Anyone can see Beth Cavendish or Humphrey Geller will go places, but only those of us who've seen the wider world recognize the potential in someone like Asano and someone like you.
Me?
You have what it takes, she said. People couldn't see that with you chained to my son. I've been selfish in binding you to him, because that helped keep my son alive. You have my apologies for that, but not my regret.
You have no need to apologize, Lady Mercer.
You're such a good boy, Neil. But don't lie to my face.
She chuckled at Neil's nervous expression.
It's an interesting team that Jason and Humphrey have put together, she said. I've recently met another of their team members, who is an interesting young man from the Magic Society. He's capable enough that Emir Bahadir is trying to poach him.
Asano told me that was for non-combat skills, Neil said.
And so it is, Thalia said. But why did he tell you that? He wanted you curious so that you would learn for yourself that the man is quite capable, which he is, by the way. Danielle Geller is keeping a close eye on the team her precious boy is forming and can be trusted to excise any rot. And now you have heard it from me, you will trust it more than if Jason told you the man was good.
What about Asano's indentured servant?
I'm not sure, Thalia said. Danielle told me she is reserving judgment for the moment. I will say that running rings around the city's iron rank adventurers for months speaks to a certain capability, regardless of what help she received. Now she has a full set of essences. Who knows what she'll accomplish?
You seem quite certain I should join, Neil said.
You should be in a team that will help you fly, instead of chaining you to the ground the way I did. My advice is that you drink your tea, leave here, and go straight to the Geller townhouse. Tell Danielle Geller you want to join her son's team.
Not Asano or Humphrey? Neil asked.
They might think they have the final word on their team members, Thalia said. It's probably best to let them.
Chapter 28. Weaponizing a barbecue. Jason met Neil at the entrance to the Cloud Palace, along with one of Emir's staff who added Neil's aura signature to the access list for the palace.
There are some restricted areas, Jason explained as they entered. You shouldn't bump into any of those except the guest suites, which are individually locked to guests who can provide you entry or not. Neil didn't say much as he looked around, wide-eyed as Jason led him to the guest wing. He was nervous, second-guessing his choice of team. But Jason was welcoming and friendly. He also seemed at home in the astounding surrounds of the Cloud Palace.
"We're going to start with a little welcoming lunch," Jason said. "You can meet the team and some of the people around it. After that, we're going to spend the afternoon on a preliminary strategy session, looking at everyone's abilities and working on the tactical concepts around them. From here on out, that's going to be our everyday. Develop tactics, workshop them in the training room, then test them in the field."
"You're getting ready for the event Bahadir is planning?" Neil asked.
"You heard about that?"
"Word has gotten around."
"Certainly, being prepared for that is a good idea," Jason said. "Our sights are set past that, though. We're looking at the path to bronze and beyond. We want to establish a playbook of strategies and tactics that we know so well as a team that we're ready to go at any moment. As our abilities grow, we can adapt and refine our repertoire. But the first step is working together, everyone knowing their potential roles. I hope you're not afraid of hard work and training."
"To be honest, Asano,
You always struck me as more frivolous than hard-working.
I'm a work-hard, play-hard kind of bloke, Jason said. Talking doesn't mean much, though. You can judge for yourself.
Jason led Neil onto an elevating platform that lifted them to the upper reaches of the Cloud Palace, before heading out to a terrace crowded with people, tables of food, and a pair of large flame grills. Amongst the crowd were people Neil recognised. Rufus Ramore was chatting with Vincent Trenslow and his absurd moustache. Humphrey Geller was flipping meat on one of the grills. Danielle Geller was chatting with Emir Bahadir, both holding grilled meat and vegetable sticks. He even spotted his friend and previous teammate, Dustin, biting into a steak sandwich. Dustin's cousin, Hudson, was next to him, and they were surrounded by their respective teams. Dustin was on a Geller team now, looking more relaxed than Neil had seen him in a long time.
"What's all this?" Neil asked.
"If you're going to chuck a barbie," Jason said, "you get some mates around. Let's grab some tucker and I'll make some introductions."
The barbecue lunch went on into the afternoon, leaving Neil disoriented from a heady mix of grilled meats, quality alcohol, and the kind of political connections his family only dreamed of. It was a social event wholly unlike those he had experienced in the Mercer's orbit. Everything was casual, and the people present genuinely seemed to like each other. There was no carefully orchestrated social sniping, no playing one family against another. There was no stratification of rank, with bronze, silver, and even gold rankers happily chatting with iron. Instead of dainty, delicate finger food, people had meat piled into plates, skewered onto sticks, or shoved between slabs of bread. There were tables of side dishes heaped into enormous bowls for anyone to grab by the tongful. Neil could hear the voice of his mother telling him to be mercenary, ditch Asano, and seize the opportunity and forge connections. The voice seemed at a loss as Jason led him around, making introductions with no prompting on his part. People asked him questions, seeming actually interested, instead of just digging for some useful tidbit they could use later.
"How long have you been in Greenstone?" Neil asked Jason, between conversations.
"About 5 months."
"How did you make these kinds of political allies in 5 months?
"I didn't," Jason said. "I made friends."
Jason found Humphrey away from the group, looking unhappy as he stared out over the ocean. Jason joined him in leaning on the rail.
"What's got you down, mate?"
"It's Gabrielle," Humphrey said. "Things aren't going to work out with her."
"That sucks," Jason said.
"Sorry to hear it."
"I'm guessing I wasn't helpful in that regard."
"It's more than just that," Humphrey said. "I would never ask her to choose between me and her religion, but she's becoming more and more dogmatic. She's becoming honest to the point of rudeness, demanding secrets she has no right to."
"Well, I'd do the rude honesty thing too," Jason said. "But in my defense, I also lie a lot."
Humphrey laughed, then sighed.
"She started telling me who I shouldn't spend my time with," he said. "It's why she's not here. She really doesn't like you and Rufus, but that's just the start of it. The strictures of her god are all well and good, but I'm not a follower of knowledge. She has no right to hold me to those principles."
"I'm sorry," Jason said. "I'm at least a bit responsible for nudging you in her direction."
"I'm not sorry," Humphrey said. "I care for Gabrielle, and I've enjoyed our time together. That time is just coming to an end."
"Wow," Jason said. "That's super mature of you. I was a couple of years older than you when my first big relationship ended, and I blew up my whole life over it like an idiot."
"I'm going to tell her tomorrow," Humphrey said. "She probably already knows."
"Because of her boss," Jason realized.
"Damn, that must have been really annoying, having the goddess telling her everything."
"It wasn't my favorite thing," Humphrey acknowledged.
He turned to look over at the gathering.
"How's Neil fitting in?"
"A bit shell-shocked. You think it was the right thing, bringing out the big social guns? I don't like weaponizing a barbecue."
His family have been second-tier nobility for generations, and this will get his family's support. As for Neil himself, that's up to you and me.
As things wound down, Jason and Amir sent people off, usually with food in bags, with a cheap, short-lived enchantment to keep the food inside them fresh and hot. Afterwards, Jason gathered their team together. Neil had now met the others, the lanky Clive Standish and the startlingly beautiful Sophie Wexler. Neil hadn't been sure what to expect from Jason's indentured servant, but the woman with silver hair, dark skin, and sharp, wary eyes certainly wasn't it. She was the one he had been the most uncertain about, but watching her sleek litheness made him a lot more confident. They went off to Jason's suite in the guest wing. Amongst all the cloud furniture, a trio of wooden bookcases stood out, jammed full of leather-bound tomes. Even more books were stacked up on a table next to a reading chair, one of which Clive picked up to examine.
"This is some heavy theory," he said to Jason. "You're finally taking my advice."
"This was Farrah's collection," Jason said sadly, gesturing at the bookcases. "She was like you, telling me to not just rely on skill books. With these, it's almost like she's still teaching me."
"Farrah was one of the Vitesse adventurers," Humphrey quietly mentioned to Neil. "She fell during the expedition."
They sat down and Jason took out a notebook. Recorded in it were the abilities of everyone in the party, to which they added Neil's. His essence combination was shield, growth, and renewal, producing the prosperity confluence. Along with healing and cleansing powers, Neil could create short-lived shields that intercepted attacks, empower allies, and replenish their mana and stamina.
"That's an awesome power set," Jason said as he wrote them down. "Not great if you get caught alone, but any team you're on should celebrate. Which is our team, I guess, so cheers, mate."
As his powers were most effective when used on allies, Neil was highly reliant on his summoning power when fighting alone. It was not a summon familiar, but a temporary summons, like Gary's Forge Golem or Farrah's Magna Elemental. It would only last for a limited time, but he could afford to risk it in ways he couldn't with a familiar. His summon was an entity called a Chrysalis Golem. It was a crystalline construct monster. It could create a protective shell around itself when it was badly damaged. When it emerged, it was fully repaired and adapted to resist the attacks that had previously harmed it.
"I can't wait to get a look at that thing," Jason said.
"With Humphrey's summons, that makes two, excluding the summon familiars Clive and myself have. We should be able to do some interesting things with them." Humphrey took the lead in discussions as they started devising potential strategies.
"The most fundamental thing is that we all need to have a sound grasp of each other's abilities," he said. "Neil, this is especially true for you since your abilities rely heavily on judgment and timing. You'll learn as we train, of course, but you should have at least a general idea of what each of us does before we start digging into specific tactics."
"Let's start with Humphrey then," Jason said. "His essences are Might, Magic, Wing, and Dragon. He moves faster, hits harder, and withstands more damage than most adventurers. His attacks are mostly conventional melee powers, but they're reliable and land like a truck."
"What's a truck?" Neil asked.
"Is that some kind of monster?"
"It's a big, heavy, fast thing," Jason said, grouchily. "It's not my fault your stupid world doesn't have internal combustion."
"Lots of people have internal combustion," Clive said. "Mostly from the fire essence, which is why it's common."
Jason groaned at Clive, while Humphrey picked up the explanations.
"Clive has the magic, rune, balance, and karmic essences. Unlike most humans, his focus is on spells. He can use magical weapons like staves and wands and works with his familiar to output reliable ranged damage. He also has some utility powers, trap magic, and the ability to make our enemies suffer retributive damage from attacking us."
"He also has some big-ticket attacks if he goes all out," Jason said. "If we need a single big hit, he's our guy. Those hefty spells need some setup, though, so we've already started devising strategies around them."
"Miss Wexler is an evasion-type defender," Humphrey said,
Swift, Wind, Balance, and Mystic. She is the newest of us, with many abilities still to awaken, but she is already the fastest and hardest to harm out of all of us. I have no doubt she will become increasingly formidable.
Asano is the sneaky prick of the team, Sophie said. His essences are dark, blood, sin, and doom.
Sun and doom? Neil asked. They sound like they should be on the restricted list.
They're not, Jason said. We checked.
Jason is an affliction specialist, Humphrey said. Once he goes to work, whatever he's fighting is finished, even if it seems to have gotten away. He's also a good scout with stealth and mobility.
Obviously, we don't expect you to remember all this, Humphrey said. You'll have plenty of time to learn, because that's what we do now. We get up, we meet up, then we train. Physical and mobility training we do in Old City.
When Jory renovated his clinic, Jason said, he turned his yard into a dedicated training space. So thanks for helping stop it from being knocked down.
That wasn't really me, Neil said.
Of course it was, Jason said. If you didn't stand up to them and force the confrontation, the healer might have waited until they tore down the place and then smote them all as sinners.
We'll be alternating our time between developing strategies, refining them in practice areas, or testing them in the field, Humphrey said.
The practice areas are the training hall, here in the Cloud Palace, or in Humphrey's Mirage Chamber.
It's not my Mirage Chamber, Humphrey said.
Other than that, it'll be contracts and adventure notices, Jason said.
This is going to be our day, every day, until Emir's mysterious contest. We're going into it as strong as we can be.
Is that going to be a problem, Neil? Humphrey asked.
We're looking for someone willing to go at this hard, so if that isn't you, tell us now.
Don't worry about me, Neil said. I've been waiting for a team that takes adventuring seriously. He looked at Jason. I wasn't sure that was you.
You can judge for yourself, Jason said.
Today, we're all talk. We throw every idea at the wall and see what sticks. Tomorrow, we start figuring out what's practical and what's some overwrought notion I got into my head because I forgot simplicity is king.
They moved on to the discussion of specific strategies under the direction of Humphrey.
I think you're overlooking what should be our core strategy, Jason told Humphrey, early into the discussion.
What's that? Humphrey asked.
You, Jason said. You do more damage than most and can survive more damage than most. With Clive and Neil, we have two buffers plus shields and healing. Neil can even top off your mana. We load all of that up on you and let you go ham. Add in your mobility, and you'll be an absolute terror to whatever we're fighting.
Uncertainty crossed Humphrey's face.
Are you sure you want to rely that heavily on me?
Jason shook his head.
Oh, Humphrey. Hands up, who wants to rely on Humphrey as the core of the team?
Sophie and Clive put up their hands with Jason, Neil raising his hand right after.
It's adorable that you're modest enough that I have to tell you this, Humphrey, Jason said. But everyone likes and trusts you.
Humphrey looked around the group, embarrassed.
Now, Jason said, if we take that as our core strategy, all our tactics should be smooth adaptations of that default. What do you reckon, Humphrey?
Well, there are a few points that we need to look at, using that as a strategy. First would be identifying and distracting anyone or anything with the singular attack power to punch through the buffs and shields.
So the other team's Clive, Sophie said.
Exactly, Humphrey said. For other Clives, we want you and Jason to at least distract and interfere, or preferably put them down.
I'm not sure I love this other Clive analogy, Clive said.
What about actual Clive and the new guy? Sophie asked. They aren't as mobile as the rest of us, and if we're using a mobile attacking strategy, they'll be left exposed.
Yes, Humphrey said. They'll make a tempting target, so instead of trying to cover it, we use it.
I like it, Jason said. We've already worked up strategies using Clive as bait, so develop them and make Neil the second juicy worm on the hook. Turn what seems like a weakness into a weapon.
Clive and Neil shared a glance.
I'm not sure I like this plan, Clive said.
Chapter 29. This town ain't big enough.
The Mirage Chamber had created a sprawl of ancient desert ruins. It was a town long since dead and dry. Built into a hillside, crumbling buildings clung to the steep slope or were dug right into the yellow desert rock. Tunnels and stairwells were alternately exposed or buried by the dilapidating power of time, forming a rat's nest of unsafe passages and hidden nooks. Of the handful of intact buildings, none had a neighbour in the same condition, the slope a mess of tumbled brick and stone, half-gone walls and debris-filled hard-earth streets. The air shimmered with heat as the unyielding sun beat down on the clay and stone remnants of the town. Through the steep ruins, three teams stalked one another. Hiding and moving, they risked precarious tunnels and rooftops as they sought to find prey without becoming someone else's.
"Keep an eye on the shadows," Rick Geller warned his team. "Asano is the strongest scout in here, and we all know what he can do if we let him play his games."
"Oh, I have all kinds of games," Jason's voice echoed loudly through the ruins.
"He's doing it again," said Claire Adia, the healer and one of two elf sisters on the team. "That guy is so annoying."
"He's just trying to get you riled up," her sister said from above. "He knows he can't try what he did last time, but he'll still try and mess up your thinking." Scouting from a rooftop, Hannah Adia was an archer, the team's only remaining ranged specialist. The expedition and its aftermath claimed both Jonah and Henry Geller, their frontline guardian and their magic ranged attacker. Their new members were Dustin Kettering, a local who filled Jonah's defender role, and Rick's sister, Phoebe. Dustin's cousin, Hudson, was his counterpart on Beth Cavendish's team, and currently an enemy. Dustin was a classic defender, not very mobile, but very hard to go around or through. This put him in the role of the team member he replaced, unlike Phoebe. Instead of a ranged magic attacker, she was a fast melee attacker using unarmed combat. This forced a change in general strategy for the team, who had previously bunkered around their twin ranged attackers. Phoebe's presence failed to replicate their previous strength, but broadened their abilities. In the weeks since gaining their new members, the team had been working on strategies that were less specialized and more adaptive and versatile. Hannah stepped off the roof, dropping down lightly to rejoin the others.
"He isn't as much as a threat in this environment as he was when he had to chase him through those mangroves," Hannah said. "Did you hear how loud he called out? He's trying to draw the other team to our location."
In another part of the ruined town, Beth Cavendish and her team moved with the same caution as Rick's team did. Beth was widely known as both team leader and team healer, but it was her dangerous mix of wide area afflictions and control powers that made her a true threat. Their own archer, Emily, was likewise scouting from a rooftop vantage, but the steep slope made that tricky. The team was slowly moving uphill in search of visual and tactical advantage. Emily was a Celestine with fair skin and a gold pixie cut that matched her eyes. She wore a simple cap to keep the sun from reflecting off her hair and giving away her position. Their team was only four, compared to five each for the others, and they were being appropriately cautious. Emily moved carefully down from her hidden vantage, returning to the team.
"I have at least the direction from Asano calling out," she said. "Obviously he wants to lure us into the other team and clean up whoever's left. Do we scout it out and wait, or avoid it completely?"
"Let them thin each other out," Beth said. "Jason's team has his voice communication ability, so they have more tactical flexibility. We stay hidden and keep going for the high ground. We wait for the others to clash and then move."
"Isn't that what everyone is going to do?"
Nico asked. Nico Tomic was from the Smolder race, with dark skin and burning red eyes. Nico used fire and iron powers to deal heavy damage in melee, or combine damage and control powers at mid-range, making him the team's most versatile striker.
"Jason's team is going to be more active," Beth said. "Their defender is mobility-based and short on powers, where Rick's team has Kettering and we have Hudson. We're both stronger than his group at suffering an attack, while Humphrey is as strong an initiator as you could ask for. They'll try and catch us at a bad moment and make the most of it."
Hudson was a huge, comic book character of a man, and the guardian of Beth's team.
He wielded earth powers and, like Clive, had a racial gift evolution that moved his aptitude from special attacks to another ability type. In Hudson's case, it was conjuration, allowing him to conjure up stone weapons, shields, walls, and other objects to protect his team. As Beth predicted, the three teams were slow and careful as they moved about the ruined town. Jason's team made various attempts to bait one of their opponents into an ill-considered attack without success before regrouping to discuss the next move.
"Both teams are being extremely cautious," Humphrey said. "They aren't willing to risk extending themselves because they know they will do better defending from readiness. Everyone is waiting for an accident or a mistake that turns the tables, letting them swoop in and clean up the other teams."
"So what do we do?" Neil asked.
"Our best bet is to strike first," Sophie said, "for both of their teams. If we can overwhelm the key defender, it opens up the rest of the team to our attacks. We load up Humphrey with powers and use that to punch through their strongest front liner and clean up the rest."
"Initiating a straight-up confrontation will cost us in the long run," Humphrey said. "Even if the other team doesn't arrive in time to pincer us against the group we're already fighting, they'll be fresh and we'll be hurt when they do turn up."
"Hunkering down fits the other teams better than it does us, though," Clive said. "Our core strategy is offensive, relying on mobility and power. We're better off pitting our strengths against their strengths than our weaknesses against their, mediums."
"Their mediums?" Neil asked.
"Yes, their mediums," Clive said emphatically. "I said it, and I'll stand by it."
Jason chuckled, shaking his head.
"You're right, Clive," he said. "These aren't teams we can beat with anything but our best. Humphrey had it right, too. If we want to catch them out of position, it has to be when they're moving to capitalize on a mistake."
"What are you suggesting?" Humphrey asked.
"I'm suggesting we make the mistake that they're both looking for. They're both waiting for someone else to get in a fight, so we'll get in one and we'll ambush them as they rush to swoop in. I found a good spot when I was roaming around earlier. You're good for one of those illusion rituals you were telling me about, right, Clive?"
"In field conditions," Clive said. "If you don't want any old perception power to see through it, I can't do any better than a blank wall."
"That's fine," Jason said. "We just need them to think there's only one entrance so we can slip out as they slip in."
"So, who will we be fighting?" Sophie asked.
"Each other, obviously,"
Jason said.
Emily tilted her head, listening.
"Did you hear that?"
Beth gestured for silence. Soon after, they heard the noise of an explosive ability triggering.
"They found each other," Hudson asked.
"It might be a ruse to flush us out," Beth said. "Move slow and quiet. We wait to see if it keeps going."
They moved forward at a cautious pace, Emily scouting the path to each new piece of cover before they took it. As they drew closer to the noise, they could hear a fight in full swing, with abilities going off and multiple weapons clashing.
"All right," Beth said. "Pick up the pace, but not too much. We want to get there once they've spent themselves on each other."
They accelerated their way along the path, Emily scouting ahead again as they narrowed in on the continuing sounds of combat. As they drew closer, Emily gestured for them to stop. She came back and gathered with the rest hidden beneath a crumbling wall.
"The noise is coming from inside the hill," Emily said. "There's a collapsed building that exposed the tunnel access. I caught a glimpse of fighting inside, but didn't push my luck."
"Any other entrances?" Beth asked.
"I can't rule it out, but not that I saw," Emily said. "My guess would be one of the teams spotted the other going in and moved on them."
"All right," Beth said. "We go with our standard 3-stage assault pattern. Control powers on any loose threats, be sure and call your targets. This means you, Nico. Then we blanket the fight with area attacks and mop up whoever's still got fight in them. When you're ready, Hudson."
Hudson nodded as his body took on the color of the desert stone, flesh transmuting into living rock. He then broke out of hiding, the rest of the team on his heels. They dashed up the slope to the shattered building and into the tunnel, balancing haste and care as they moved through the rubble. The tunnel was around a dozen meters long, beyond which it opened into darkness, punctuated by flashes of magical light. They surged forward, catching glimpses of figures clashing.
It looked like several normal-sized figures against one that dwarfed even Hudson.
"Wait!" Beth called out, and they all stopped. "Plug the hole!"
Reacting without question, Hudson held a hand out ahead of them, and a slab of desert stone rose up to seal the end of the tunnel and close them off from the room.
"What is it?" Hudson asked afterwards.
"They were summons," Beth said. "Back out, now."
They started heading back down the tunnel when an arrow flew into the tunnel. It came in at an angle, striking the wall but not losing momentum as it ricocheted. Instead, the arrow duplicated, two arrows now zipping down the tunnel at different angles. They kept bouncing and multiplying as they zigzagged down the tunnel, the confines of the tunnel letting them bounce their way into a storm of arrows. Hudson acted quickly, placing another wall between them and the exit, boxing them in from both ends, but shielding them from the arrow attack.
"That's both my wall abilities," Hudson said. "I won't have them again for a while."
"You did well," Beth said, and pointed to the newer wall. "That's your Shatterstone wall, right?"
"Yeah."
"Then see if you can't clear us a path with it. Break us out of here."
Hudson walked from the front of his team to the back. The first wall he had created was the strongest, a simple wall conjuration power from his fortress essence called Bulwark. The second power was called Shatterstone Wall and could turn defense into offense. He snapped his fingers and the wall exploded away from him in a wave of sharp stone shards, peppering Rick and Dustin, who were on the other side. The cousins were on opposing teams but filled similar roles. They were both huge, shielding their respective teams with the support of their elemental powers. Hudson had transformed himself into stone, while Dustin was clad in armor forged entirely of ice. Shards of the exploding wall had dug into it without penetrating. Standing next to Dustin, Rick also had hefty armor, but without the complete coverage that Dustin enjoyed. He avoided most of the damage, but still suffered some cuts and scrapes that he was ignoring. As the two teams spotted one another, Beth was already chanting a spell.
"Let venom drift on the breeze."
She opened her mouth wide, and flower petals streamed out of it and up the tunnel. They were lotus petals, dark green, purple, and black. They swept out of the tunnel on a wash of air, blowing past her teammates without incident, yet adhering to the enemy team. Wherever they landed on flesh, they swiftly dissolved into the skin. Before the effects of the petals could be seen, Nico stepped forward and exhaled a cone of fire like a dragon. Between the mysterious petals and the roaring flame, the momentum of Rick's team was completely halted.
"Hudson!"
Beth called out. A moment later, a stone block rose up under their feet. It carried them along the tunnel like a raft in a quick current, the ground rippling like water as they passed. Hudson stood at the front, conjuring a huge stone shield as they barreled out of the tunnel. Where the stone block carried Beth's team, the hard, dry earth became soft and unsteady. As they emerged from the tunnel, Rick and Dustin were forced back as the rippling ground left them with unsure footing. From a hidden vantage, Jason's team looked on. Humphrey tapped Clive on the shoulder just as the stone raft emerged from the tunnel and Clive snapped his fingers. The magic rune that appeared went unseen under the raft, but exploded upwards nonetheless. The stone block absorbed most of the force but shattered into pieces, bursting upwards like a geyser. Beth and Emily were sent flying by the power of the explosion, cut and bludgeoned by chunks of stone. Hudson and Nico had been held in place by their protective powers. Their conditions reflected the strength of those powers. Nico staggered, injured and disoriented, while Hudson was entirely unharmed. He looked around, taking stock of Rick's team. Rick himself looked singed, but was functionally uninjured, although he felt woozy from the poison petals that had found their way onto his exposed hands and face. Dustin was standing strong, as was his ice armor. It was pushing out the stone shards from the wall explosion and sealing over the cracks. There was some melting from the fire breath, but that was likewise recovering in short order. Phoebe was unarmored and had been right behind Rick and Dustin, ready to move down the tunnel before they were pushed back. She had moved to use Dustin as a shield from the fire breath, but had been subjected to the bulk of the poison petals. She had already dashed backwards, holding out a hand, palm up. Droplets of black, purple, and green liquid started falling upwards from her palm, collecting in a small orb floating over her hand.
As Phoebe was purging the poison from herself, the last members of her team were already going to work. The elf sisters had been well back, avoiding the area attacks. Claire was purging the poison from Rick with a spell as Hannah knocked an arrow to her bow. The arrowhead was glowing, the light rapidly increasing in intensity until it started strobing. She aimed it at Beth, who was still prone from the explosion. Things were happening all at once as chaos ruled the battlefield. Phoebe gestured with her hand and the poison orb flew at Emily, the enemy archer who, like Beth, was still sprawled on the ground. Hudson had seen Hannah readying the arrow and moved to get in its path before it was loosed, but Dustin intercepted him. Rick and Nico moved on each other, Rick already holding a sword as a huge iron hammer appeared in Nico's hands. Nico grew visibly larger, and the crude hammer grew with him. Even the handle was made of dark iron, which started to glow with heat. Hannah released the arrow at Beth, only for Hudson to appear in her place while she appeared where he had just been standing. The glowing arrow tore a chunk out of Hudson's torso, which crumbled off him in stony fragments. Dustin, suddenly finding Beth in front of him, conjured a hatchet of ice in each hand and started swinging. Beth activated an ability she shared with Sophie called Between the Raindrops. She had obtained it through the water essence instead of the swift essence, but it was functionally the same. Her spatial awareness and reflexes took a leap forward at the cost of rapidly consuming stamina and mana, which was worth it to escape Dustin's attacks. After throwing the poison orb, Phoebe was moving before it even struck. Emily held out a hand into which an arrow appeared, the tip glowing. As the poison orb struck her, she jabbed the arrow into the ground. There was a shockwave, launching Phoebe backward and Emily herself into the air. She was unharmed by her own power, even using the momentum to flip backwards and land on her feet. She was immediately woozy, however, as the poison orb took effect. From their vantage point, Jason's team watched the conflict unfold.
"Things are stabilizing," Humphrey said. "It's time to join in, make things messy again. Everyone knows what to do."
The team nodded, and Humphrey looked up, teleporting high into the sky. Chapter 30. The Second Best Iron Ranker. After the initial chaos, the two clashing teams were starting to get their bearings. This was the moment that Winged Death plunged out of the sky in the form of Humphrey Geller. Careening downwards with his dive bomb special attack, wings splayed out behind him. His powers were amplified by both Clive and Neil. A circle of magical runes floated around him, and his sword glowed with light. He was twice his normal size, with an attendant increase in strength from Neil's giant's might spell. Humphrey had a sword pointed down in a reverse double-fisted grip. Hudson was still prone from his switch teleport with Beth when Humphrey landed with literally earth-shattering force as his blade smashed into Hudson, smashing off chunks of his stone body. The blade of Humphrey's sword found the exact spot where Hudson had just been injured, imparting all the power of multiple buffs, the massive fall, and two of Humphrey's special attacks combined. Almost any Iron Ranker would have died from that single blow alone, but Hudson was not just any Iron Ranker. More than half of his torso and one arm were just gone, shattered into stone dust. He was still massively injured and lying prone as Humphrey stood up from the crouch he had landed in, still almost double his normal height from Neil's spell. He lifted up his sword and brought it down again. Hudson lifted his remaining arm and a stone shield appeared to intercept the attack. The incredible impact of Humphrey's entry to the battlefield drew all eyes as the rest of his team emerged unnoticed. Clive had a large staff, from which he fired a bolt of magic at the elf sisters. Claire and Hannah were largely separated from the battle, leaving them free to heal and offer ranged support, respectively. Neil also stepped out with Clive, but didn't act, instead making himself ready to intercede with his abilities at need. A third team member, Onslow the Rune Tortoise, was not a born ambusher and was sedately emerging from cover behind them. The blast from Clive's staff crackled over Claire's shield, dissipating without any effect beyond drawing the attention of the two elves. The sisters failed to realize that this was the point, as they turned to face Clive and Neil and away from their shadows thrown onto the ground by the bright sun.
With Jason's well-honed aura control, they failed to notice his dark figure rise up from Claire's own shadow. Claire fired a blast from a wand as Hannah launched an arrow that caught fire in flight. Both Clive and Neil had the same mana shield power as Claire, the attack striking their invisible shields. Mana shield was a power that each of them gained from different essences, but the effects were the same, negating attacks at the cost of mana. The weaknesses were also the same, however. Not impending non-attacks, or attacks made from inside their sphere. It was a weakness that had cost Claire before, with Jason's leeches, and it was about to cost her again. Standing behind her, Jason slashed his hand on the razor in his wristband and reached inside Claire's shield. Leeches spilled out over her, prompting startling shrieks that had her sister spinning around to see what happened. Jason pointed his arm at Hannah, who was likewise sprayed with leeches. Both sisters wore a coat of toothy leeches, and Team Colin, Jason's most powerful and horrifying familiar, went to work. Hudson's switch teleport had moved Beth out of the path of an arrow, but placed her squarely in front of Dustin and his ice hatchets. Her between the raindrops power let her avoid his attack and escape his immediate reach, but not his attack range. He started throwing ice spikes, forcing her to keep her attention on him and not the battlefield. She had no time to assess her team's condition, let alone direct them as she was used to. From the moment Rick's team had boxed her in, through their breakaway being aborted by whatever had blown up Hudson's stone raft, she had been on the back foot. Beth's archer, Emily, was likewise under pressure. She was staging a fighting retreat as she was pursued relentlessly by the swift and powerful Phoebe Geller. Affected by the poison orb Phoebe had used on her, Emily landed arrows on Phoebe but only inflicted minor injuries. Phoebe wasn't deterred, slowly but surely closing the gap. In the meantime, Humphrey was still pounding away at Beth's frontliner, Hudson. Hudson was very much at his limits, scrambling on the ground and conjuring shield after shield for Humphrey to smash through. Despite his buffs, Humphrey was finding Hudson frustratingly difficult to finish off. His size buff had worn off, reducing Humphrey to normal proportions, but he didn't relent. The last member of Beth's team was Nico, using his fire and iron powers to clash with Rick Geller. Nico's powers included a size buff he could use on himself, but the extra space he occupied was proving more of a detriment than the strength was an asset. Knee-deep in mud against a swarm of leeches, Rick wasn't much of a fighter. But this was open ground. With free footing and a large, singular enemy, Rick was a horror to engage in melee, an avatar of speed and power whose attacks were as potent as they were relentless. Of the 14 combatants on the field, none of them were bad, but Rick was the leader of his team for a reason. No one would accuse Nico of lacking as an adventurer, but Rick simply outclassed him. He unleashed on Nico all the frustration of setback after setback his team had suffered, losing not just team members, but family. Rick was relentless and overpowering, his sword finding Nico again and again, leaving Nico stumbling back, rapidly accruing injuries. Beth bought herself time by making use of Dustin's own power. One of her quick attack spells was called Water Cutter, which fired a beam of water hard and tight enough to cut through at least non-magical metal. In between Ice Spike, she fired it directly into Dustin's face. It didn't fully penetrate his icy helmet, but the water froze over the front of it from the cold of his armor, blinding him with an opaque sheet of ice. Dustin wasn't worried as he smashed the ice away with a fist. Beth lacked the powers to harm him in the brief moment he took to clear his vision. Attacking was not the reason she had bought that time, however. She took it to scan the battlefield. She saw her team members scattered and on the back foot. They were about to be wiped out, and she knew she had to intervene, chanting a spell as Dustin cleared off the obscuring ice. He threw an ice spike at her, but she swayed out of its path and continued her incantation.
Cool waters be the crucible of deliverance, bringing the deserving into the chrysalis of peace and rebirth.
Just as Dustin reached her, giant magical lotus flowers appeared around Beth, Emily, and Nico, completely enveloping them. Beth didn't complete her spell in time to save Hudson, who had finally been finished off by Humphrey. The people attacking the three, now hidden away inside the lotuses, found their attacks bouncing harmlessly off.
They can't do anything from inside there, but we can't hurt them either. Humphrey communicated through the group chat.
Go for Rick's team.
Jason's sneak attack had devastated the elf sisters, who were thrashing on the ground under piles of bloody leeches. Sophie, yet to make an appearance, suddenly launched a sneak attack at Phoebe, who was at a loss in front of the lotus-shrouded Emily. She dodged the sneak attack, dancing away to create distance, and the women squared off.
You should have Asano work on your aura retraction, Phoebe said. His is practically imperceptible, while yours just gave you away.
Sneaking is really his area, Sophie said. I'm more about the punching, and you don't need an aura for that.
They clashed in a series of strikes before one of Phoebe's special attacks blasted them apart, both women landing nimbly.
You made a mistake even coming for me, Phoebe said. If you'd gone for Beth, she wouldn't have shielded her team.
But then we'd have to fight both teams,
Sophie said with a malevolent grin. Phoebe's eyes went wide with realization.
Humphrey knows Beth's abilities, she said. He predicted what she'd do.
Humphrey's a good guy and wouldn't say it, Sophie said. But I think he's sick of being called the second best Iron Ranker.
Phoebe glanced around the battle. The elf sisters weren't coming back from their predicament, but Rick and Dustin had regrouped to take on Humphrey. Jason stepped out of a nearby shadow.
It's nice that you made a friend, but you're meant to be fighting her, he told Sophie.
I'm new at this, Sophie said. I was waiting for a big, strong man to save me.
Is that right? He asked.
It is, Sophie said. If you could go get Humphrey, that would be great.
Well, that's just hurtful, Jason said.
You know I'm still here, right? Phoebe said.
I suppose we should deal with you, Jason said.
Oh, you're going to deal with me, are you?
That's the plan, Jason said. Keep her busy, would you, Wexler?
Sophie launched into the attack before he finished talking, Phoebe deftly defending. Jason looked at Phoebe.
Bleed for me.
Blood started running from Phoebe's eyes and nose as he cast another spell. Carry the mark of your transgressions. Phoebe was distracted as a sigil seared itself onto her face, taking a fist to the ribs from Sophie.
Your fate is to suffer.
You have some nasty damn spells,
Phoebe said, still clashing with Sophie. Suddenly she broke free and lunged at Jason. As she moved, she saw him throw something at the ground, and she found herself shrouded in murky darkness. It wasn't full darkness, as she could see shapes moving in the strange zone of shadows. She recognized the effect as one of his throwing darts, and knew it only covered a small area. Making an immediate break for the outside, she felt a light slice on her arm as she emerged into the light. Fully aware of what Jason's powers could do, Phoebe held her hand out to purge the toxins, the way she had earlier by gathering them into an orb. Sophie didn't give her the chance, forcing her to defend against a renewed series of attacks. In their initial clash, Phoebe had the advantage. Sophie had the edge in fighting technique, but Phoebe had more powers and more experience using them. The tables were turned as Phoebe needed to get away and cleanse herself before Jason's afflictions overwhelmed her. While Phoebe was stronger, though, Sophie's powers combined defense with blistering speed. She wouldn't be able to take Sophie down quickly or outpace her and escape. While Sophie and Jason confronted Phoebe, Rick and Dustin regrouped as their opponents were closed off in the lotuses. Instead, they turned on Humphrey, fresh from finishing Hudson. All else being equal, Humphrey and Rick were a good match with quite similar combat styles. The addition of Dustin helped Rick, but Humphrey had Clive, Neil, and the finally emerged Onslow the Rune Tortoise to back him up. Neil's ability to buff and heal was valuable, but not difficult to use. What had arrested the attention of Rufus Remore was Neil's shielding powers. The shield abilities that he could use on allies lasted only moments and would end after absorbing only a single attack. Without good judgment and timing, both could be easily wasted, leaving them unavailable until they came off cooldown again. The ability Burst Shield blasted away anyone nearby when the shield intercepted an attack. The other ability, Absorbing Shield, replenished the mana of the shielded person. The more damage that was prevented, the more mana was restored. Using the voice chat, Neil offered to reapply the size growth power, but Humphrey refused, not making Nico's mistake. Clive refreshed his buffs, the rune circle that triggered effects when attacked, and the damage reflecting damage buff, Mantle of Retribution. Neil did refresh his other buff power, Armor of Renewal, which reduced damage taken and gave healing over time. Humphrey clashed with Dustin and Rick. The two opponents should have been pressuring him, but Humphrey had spent weeks discovering his limits under the protection of Clive and Neil. He left openings so he could make attacks, trusting Neil's shielding and healing, while letting Clive's retributive effects trigger. Clive offered range support, alternating staff blasts with using his own mana to recharge Onslow's shell powers. The 3-on-2 was disadvantageous to Rick and Dustin, but they were holding on. They had also been training hard, and Dustin used his ice powers to protect Rick and set up counters. Powerful attacks from Humphrey found his sword hitting a suddenly appearing ice wall that exploded into razor shards that slashed at him like knives. Blasts of icy air knocked him away and slowed his reflexes with cold debuffs. Humphrey feinted against Rick to strike out at Dustin, only for Dustin to be replaced with an ice clone as he teleported a short distance away. The ice clone shattered under the attack, once again peppering Humphrey with ice razors. It was not enough. Humphrey pushed them further and further onto the back foot, their attacks either shielded or healed by Neil's life bolt spell. It was clear that if nothing changed, they would inevitably lose out.
"Go for the healer," Rick barked.
Dustin disengaged, Humphrey not trying to stop him. Dustin charged at Clive and Neil as Humphrey used Rick's distraction to catch him square in the chest with a kick, sending him staggering back. To Rick's surprise, instead of pushing the advantage, Humphrey looked up at the sky and teleported away. Clive looked up at Humphrey, more than 100 meters in the air, then down at the charging Dustin. He smiled and chanted a spell.
"Exchange your fates."
Suddenly Humphrey was standing where Dustin had been charging Clive. Rick looked over in confusion, then up at the sky, as a sound grew louder and louder. Dustin's scream came to an end at the same time his fall did. Rick's team was effectively done. The sisters had succumbed to Colin. Phoebe was still alive but too debilitated to fight, which left Rick as the only active combatant. Humphrey turned back to face him, but Clive's vision power could see the magic of the lotus shells was about to end and warned the team. Humphrey directed the team to quickly gather, which didn't take long. He was already close to Clive and Neil while Jason appeared from a nearby shadow. Sophie moved so fast, it looked like she was skimming above the ground instead of running. Inside her lotus shell, Beth had no idea what awaited her outside. She would have to rely on quick actions and quicker thinking when her spell dropped. Losing Hudson was a blow, but Nico and Emily would be fully healed, with refreshed mana and stamina. She hoped Humphrey and Rick's teams had taken the time to tear each other apart, which would allow her team to emerge and mop up. The lotus shell dropped, and her eyes fell immediately on Humphrey's team. They looked unharmed, but they were gathered together in an easy clump. She cast a spell, eager to get it off before they reacted to the shells dropping and scattered.
"Steel-cutter thorns, burst forth and make the land your own."
Thorny vines erupted from the hard earth, splitting rock as they emerged, completely encapsulating Jason's team. Sharp thorns dug into them, even piercing Humphrey's conjured dragon scale armor. They didn't penetrate far, but they were all bound such that any movement would cause the thorns to dig into them.